So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming this morning. Can everybody hear me? Good. Before I begin our Dharma talk this morning, I wanted to announce, I've been asked to announce, and I'm very happy to announce, many of you know that we have been involved over these past months in a capital campaign to raise enough money to complete our meditation gardens so we can have a beautiful place for people to come to, and to a place that just in being here will bring happiness and a sense of harmony and peace to people, but also to have walking, outdoor walking meditation paths and places for people to meditate outside, as well as the reconfiguration of our education building to be able to put up people overnight so we can have retreats here. So this campaign was our third campaign in 2.5 years. And those people, there were a number of people, or some people in our community who said, you never do that. I mean, like, one is enough. But to ask two times, and then three times within such a short period of time, was breaking all the rules of whoever makes these kinds of rules up. But I am quite delighted to announce to you that our capital campaign, which we had set to be completed on April 30th and to raise $175,000, has been completed on time. And that is due to the generosity of our members and also non-members who contributed it. It is because of the generosity of people in our community because all the organization of and all the tracking of, and actually everybody in our community, nearly 200 people, were contacted by phone by a fellow member to describe to them this initiative and to get their feedback. So much gratitude is directed in all directions. But to be honest with you, I never had a doubt. I never had a doubt because I believe that what we are doing here has great value for our world. And we live in a time where that which is meaningful, that which is unadulterated, that which is authentic, is not easily found. And my sense is that when people are offered something of quality and value and meaning, there will always be those who recognize it and value it and will want to support it in whatever way they can. I think the growth of interest in Buddhism and mindfulness, meditation, is part of a larger movement within our society among certain sectors of this seeking. In the same way that people are seeking fresh foods, organic foods, unadulterated foods, unprocessed foods, people are looking for spiritual paths that are not overly processed, that still have nutritional value. This Dharma has great nutritional value and has nurtured and nourished people's healing and transformation for thousands of years. And so, again, I never doubted for a moment that what we are doing here, not because we're doing it, but because what we're offering, not just only in terms of our teachings and activities, but offering a place where people can come to learn the basics of this process of healing and transformation. And can come to a place where they can feel that. I think is so important for this age. It is not just a religious statement or a spiritual statement. I think it's a political statement. Because politics is about how do we affect our communities and our society. I think we've gotten a little off stream in thinking it's just about elections. I think it's about this. And we're hopefully just part of this bigger thing, where we create places in which the values we believe in are actually practiced. Not just talked about at election time, but are cultivated ongoing. And that the values that we want to see in the world, the way human beings treat one another, take care of one another, and what is important in the world in terms of what we do with our thinking, what we do with our energy, what are the activities we do in life to produce meaning? We have an opportunity here together to do that. And I think people will recognize that. And again, I'm not saying that this is the only place. Obviously, we need millions of places like this in many different ways. This needs to be expressed. So again, I was asked to announce, and I'm very happy to announce, that our capital campaign is done, and we have accomplished our goal. And hopefully over these next 6 months, you will see a transformation occurring outdoors as well as in the building next door. And my hope is by next fall, we may be able to hold our first retreat here, which would be wonderful. Maybe that was the universe saying something. For those who believe in that kind of stuff. For those who have been coming a while, know that for these last 6 or 8 months, we have been focusing both in our weekly Sangha gatherings, but also in an intensive practice periods that I think 80 or 90 people have been involved with since the fall, on the seven factors of awakening. These teachings that demystify what it means to have an awakened mind, to lead an awakened life, what it is and what it isn't. And again, we have been looking deeply into that. That intensive is the final week of the intensive. And I want to talk today about one of the factors of awakening, which is happiness. Many people, when they think about mindfulness, they think about, being present too, which can sound fairly neutral. I know that I am breathing. I know that I am walking. I know that I'm drinking a cup of tea. I'm knowing that I see you. I know that I'm hearing you. And so mindfulness by itself can seem sort of a neutral kind of activity. But I think it's important to understand that the Buddha and Buddhism have always talked about happiness, joy, well-being as factors of the awakened mind. And the awakened mind is not something that only occurs in awakened people as a solid state. Many people mistakenly believe that. But it is something that is experienced and generated moment to moment. So one always has the capacity throughout one's day, throughout one's life, to generate a mind that is characterized as awakened, enlightened, in the same way that one has the opportunity throughout the day to generate the opposite, most people, not knowing about the qualities of the awakened mind, of the enlightened mind, don't realize that much of what they're generating every day, the mind states, the conversations, the emotions, are not of an awakened or an enlightened nature. They are of the opposite. We are unfortunately experiencing throughout the day mind states that are not one of ease and joy and well-being and equanimity. We are often experiencing the opposite, both in our mind and also in our speech and also in our interactions. So the understanding that there is this awakened mind that has these factors and that it can be lived, and it can be lived moment to moment, which means even if 20 minutes ago I indulged my habit energy of affliction, of wrong thinking, in this moment right now I can be cultivating and generating a very different mind. So one of the seven factors is this factor of happiness or joy. And I wanted to go back to one of the earliest teachings of the Buddha called the Dhammapada, which is just a series of verses purported to be have been spoken by the Buddha. And I have three verses. And they're from chapter 15. So one verse says, oh, let us live, and actually this is called, the verses are called happiness. And the first one says, oh, let us live happily without hate among those who hate. Among those who hate, we dwell without hate. Oh, let us live happily without craving amongst those who crave. Among those who crave, we dwell without craving. And the third is, oh, let us live happily without impediments. Let us feed on joy like the gods of the radiant realm. I think the first one, oh, let us live happily without hate amongst those who hate, amongst men and those and women who hate, we dwell without hate. This is very all-encompassing, isn't it? Because I think what these are telling us is that even though we may live in a world, and a world doesn't just mean the big world, but it can mean the very immediate world of those people we deal with day to day, that even though afflictive emotions are present, anger, hate, right? All kinds of negative emotions are, you know, gossip, backbiting. I'm trying to think very practically what we hear. Minds that are always judgmental, minds that are not accepting, minds that are always pointing out the negative. I mean, this is so much the culture in the media is so much like that. There's so much negativity. There's so much hatred. I mean, people do not, the opposite of hatred is love. We do not see great love. Love, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, is understanding. We don't see much attempts at understanding. So this is the world that we live in, and especially because of the power of the media, internet, and all these things, we are saturated in it. Right. A couple hundred years ago, before all this media stuff and electronics, it wasn't so omnipresent in our life. We didn't have to, we could pick up the newspaper or not, but otherwise you didn't hear it. I mean, you might hear it in your immediate thing, but here it's everywhere. Oh, let us live happily without hate among those who hate, among those who hate, we dwell without hate. There's the instructions. And there's the acknowledgement from 2,600 years ago that the environment can often be negative, that the environment could often be toxic, both in the immediacy. I mean, many people talk about those kinds of environments in their extended families, or people talk about that in their workplace, or in various endeavors they're involved in. About this is the culture. It's kind of a toxic. It's kind of a negative culture. There's a lot of negative energy around. Everyone know what we're talking about, right? We all know that. We all know these kind of places. So we are instructed that our job is to live in an opposite way in the midst of that. Is that clear? It's not about how can I get away from that? These people drive me nuts. These people are so toxic. I got to get away from these toxic people. No, because we'll never do that unless we really, you know, physically remove ourselves from the world. But if we are not, if we know that that is not the answer, right, that we're here to transform the world, that we cannot transform it by living totally in opposition to it, kind of geographically, but we can only transform it by standing and being and acting in a totally different way in the midst of. Can you see? That's a challenge, isn't it? Because in a certain sense, it would seem much easier just to get away, right? But again, there's no escape. Because even if you got away from everybody, you'd still be left with yourself, and you may discover there's a level of toxicity within our own minds that we are bringing with us. So after a while of running and changing and always trying to, get everybody else straight, we realize we need to get ourselves straight. So how do you live happily among those who hate? How do you dwell in happiness among those who hate? Well, it's not that hard. It is hard when we live externally, when we're always looking out and always reacting to what's going on around us, right? In our thoughts, in our emotions, in our actions, in our speech, if we are always just reacting, and we're reacting to because we are obsessed by this. We are obsessed by the negativity of certain people. Right? How does it get inside us? What is the mechanism that this toxicity, this negativity of others, makes us negative? Right? There's nothing physical that can be seen, right? In other words, if there's a bottle of poison here, it's a physical thing. If I drink it, you can clearly see how I got poisoned. Right? There's a physical trail of evidence. But how does another person's anger or whatever their mood is, how does that get inside me? You can't find that trail. There's no chain of evidence, right? Is that clear? So you have to ask yourself, well, how does it? Well, it's obviously because when it is occurring, we take it in. We think about it. We ruminate about it. We obsess about it. We replay it over and over again in our minds, right? That's how it gets inside us. It has no capacity on its own to do it. Right? When we understand that, and that is an understanding that can be a conceptual, and that is an understanding that is better to be understood through meditation, where we really understand more deeply our minds. We then have the answer One, the answer of how not to take in the toxicity, that we have the ability not to. Right? But you need a strong mind. You need a clear mind. And this is something that this is what we develop through meditation. So at the same time that everyone else may be cultivating this kind of toxic way of thinking and acting and speaking and etc., we're not. Right? We're cultivating something else. And we are certainly not having a toxic reaction to toxic people. I mean, that's really nuts. Right? I just hate hateful people. It just fills me with hatred. Knowing there are people in this world who hate. I hate them. Right, but I mean, this is the way we are. It's like we compound the damage and we become that which we hate, we could say it. So it is important that two things are going on. One is we understand. See what? So somebody might say, "Well, how do I deal living in this hateful situation? How do I dwell happily?" Right? Well, one is I understand. See, understanding. I understand the causes and conditions that have created them. It's not personal. It's not personal. I understand that everything, everyone, is the product of causes and conditions. That is the basic operating principle of this world. And so I have understanding, which allows me to accept. Not accept like in an ethical, moral way, but to accept in a very pragmatic, real way. Like this is the way they are. So I have understanding. And I have compassion because I understand that anybody who has a lot of toxicity in them is suffering. They are not happy people. They are not people at peace, at ease. They are burning up from their own toxicity within them. And I understand that. So I have understanding, I have compassion. But at the same time, I am clear what I want to be cultivating, right? That in my own mind, I want to be cultivating a peaceful mind, a mind at ease, a mind of understanding, a mind of happiness, a mind of well-being, a mind of equanimity, right? That's where my focus is. But most people, their focus, if they look at the content of what's going on up here all day, it's all about what? It's all about out there. What she did and he did or didn't do, that. So, please understand that the capacity to live happily in the midst of hatred is available to all of us. And the more toxicity, the more hatred and anger and all kinds of afflictive things and intolerance and all that, the more that we need to practice. That should be an inspiration to us. Let us live happily without craving amongst those who crave. Now this is interesting, right? Because this is 2,600 years ago, right? And you might go, wow, what did they know about craving? I mean, right? We live in a culture that is based on what? Craving. You're always supposed to be wanting, needing something. That's like the fundamental, I mean, it's the basis of our economy, our consumer economy. It's just the basis of the way we talk to each other. You know? What are you craving these days? Well, it must be something you're craving. Right? If you're not craving, thirsting, needing, wanting, then people must think you're clinically depressed. That you need to go on medication or something. Or let us live happily without craving. And again, craving, again, please understand that these are simple words that are usually stand-in for a multitude of words. So what the Buddha is talking about here is not just, hungry and wanting to eat something to eat, or needing some new clothes, or you know what I mean? It's that mind that is always seeking something. It is the mind that doesn't feel at peace. It is the mind that is always a little dissatisfied and is wanting something, needing something. Whether that's I need something, I need to eat something right now, I gotta go shopping, I gotta do something right now, right? Or whether it's just the whole deal of always wanting, needing something more. Why are we always wanting and needing something more? Because we are not satisfied with the way things are. Right? There has to be something wrong with this present moment to want another kind of moment. How to live happily without craving amongst those who crave, those who thirst, those who grasp, those who are always needing. Again, it's the same dilemma. There has to be, our response has to be one of understanding the external world. Why are people doing that all the time? Because they want to be happy. And they think by getting that raise, by getting that new job, by getting that new relationship, by getting that new car, by getting to see the latest new movie, by getting to read the latest bestseller, by, you know, endlessly going on and on and on, you know, by having a good weekend, by having a good vacation, by, you know, all the things that we're always endlessly looking forward from, we understand after a certain time that that will not give us happiness. It will give us a temporary happiness. That is the opposite of our unhappiness. The two of them go together. But that will not give us the real inner happiness, well-being, peace of mind that I think human beings, whether they know it or not, really want. So again, how do you live in this world without calling it craving? How do we live in this consumer-driven society? This artificially primed, endlessly priming needs and wants that we're constantly barraged with in images. How do you live in the midst of that? Well, one, you understand what they're up to, right? You understand what they're up to, what they're selling. They're packaging something that looks like if you get it, you will be happy. You will feel good. Right? So there has to be some understanding, you know, that that's not true. That doesn't give me what I really seek. So we have to know what we really seek in this life. So one sees the inherent unsatisfactory of that need-driven, wanting, craving, thirsting, must-have, mind, and how that mind in and of itself is a kind of suffering. We understand that, but at the same time, like in the first verse, we are cultivating something else. Through these practices, we are learning how to cultivate ease, well-being, peace of mind, inner joy that is not dependent, this is important, not dependent on external circumstances. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't prefer to live in comfortable and pleasing external circumstances, right? It doesn't mean, you know, if I go to work, it wouldn't it be nice to go to work with a bunch of people that I really liked, that we enjoyed, that I could really trust, that we was comfortable with? Well, of course, it doesn't mean that natural, right? But it means it's not like that. I can work with anything because I know how to work with anything. Because at the end of the day, I understand that I myself can cultivate ease and well-being and peace of mind and open-heartedness that it's self-generating. Is that clear? That's what it really means to have a spiritual life and a spiritual practice. It means that it's internally driven. It's not externally driven. And again, that doesn't mean you wouldn't like to have good relationships rather than bad relationships, and you wouldn't like to have a good workplace, and you know what I mean? It means you wouldn't have like to have a nice home, and you wouldn't like things to go your way rather than things not go your way. You know, that's all accepted, but it's understood that that doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes in our life it may happen more, other times in our life it may happen less, right? There's a movement there. But either way, it's all okay. So again, it needs we need this inner life to be one in the world of all these of all this negativity, and not to become negative. Right? To maintain a loving, open heart, even in the midst of hatred and intolerance and all that stuff. And that in this world where people are endlessly driven to need and to want and to always be externally obsessed, that we can develop this rich inner life in which we know, I don't need anything to be happy. Again, I don't need anything. I know how to dwell within. I know how to enjoy my breathing, Thich Nhat Hanh, learn to enjoy your breathing. You know, learn to enjoy just walking on the earth. I know how to, my mindfulness, as I said earlier, is not just something that is neutral. My mindfulness is something where I can turn my mind to those things that nourish me. But to those things that bring happiness. To those things that bring good feelings into my mind. I know how to touch those things. I know how to look up from the road and the traffic and see the sky. Oh, right, the sky is still there. For a moment there, the world was reduced to traffic. And my need to get from somewhere to somewhere and not being happy that I can't fulfill my need. That other people are not behaving the way I want. Oh, the blue sky is still there. The clouds are still there. Trees and flowers and human beings are still there. It's kind of just learning how to shift. Right? That the mind that's obsessed with negativity, a mind that's obsessed with what's wrong. We're always focused obsessively about even little things that go wrong in our life. Right? And not noticing all the things that are going right. All the goodness in life. The goodness in our life. Why aren't we obsessing about that? I mean, if we want something to obsess about, to ruminate around, why don't we ruminate around things that produce good feelings within us? Can you see how crazy it is? Instead, we obsess and ruminate over and over again about things that just make us feel worse, angrier, more hurt, sadder, scareder, right? I mean, it's over and over and over and over again. And then we wonder why, you know, why don't I have peace of mind? Why don't I have a joyful heart? This is a world of cause and effect. We can make causes in this life for happiness, for ourselves and others, or we can make causes in our life for unhappiness. And it's really as simple as that. A spiritual path clearly delineates what is the path that causes affliction and what is the path that causes awakening. Freedom from affliction. And this is not something you need a PhD with. You don't even need a master's degree. You don't even need a bachelor's degree. You probably don't even need a high school degree, but if you're in high school, it's probably good to complete it for various reasons. But they may not have to do with happiness. is all very simple. Let us live happily without impediments. Let us feed on joy like the gods of the radiant realm. Again, this is very important. Because for many of us, we live in a world we constantly think there are impediments, there are obstacles, there are challenges. To what? To our peaceful mind, to our happiness, to our open-heartedness. We think there are impediments. Right? Like we have these issues that are impediments, that we have these people, that we have these situations that are impediments, obstacles. That we have our childhood. Many people think, well, it's my childhood. It's my growing up. You know, this is my impediment. This is, you know. So we live in a world where we, even though we may have this sense of another way to live, another possibility for human beings, for the world, and for ourselves, we also see these strong impediments, these strong obstacles, these difficult challenges that prevent us from doing it. He says, let us live in happily without impediments. Let us feed on joy. Well, that's an interesting food, right? It's not in the cereal section at Publix. Let us feed on joy. What are the things that really bring joy? And how do we feed on them? Right. Is that clear? You could have been eating junk food your whole life, morning, noon, and night, right? And when somebody tells you about healthy eating, you may say, but look what? Look how I've been eating for the last 30, 40, 20, 50, 60, 80 years. Look at that gigantic impediment that I have to eating healthily. And you know what I'd say? That's nonsense. Because you're talking about what's happened in the past. And the past does not exist, does it? There is nobody, even if you've been eating junk food for your whole life, who cannot today not do that. Is there? Of course not. We have always the capacity because every moment is fresh. Now, how do we learn that? Well, through meditation. Like when we, if you think back to the instructions that were given in the earlier meditation, you know, come into the present. Notice that you have a body. Notice that you're breathing. Notice the present moment. The past is not here in the present moment. It only arises as a thought, as a memory, as mind fabrication. But in reality, this is a totally fresh moment that none of us have ever been before. Has anybody ever been here before? No. In this moment, life can begin to change. Because this is fresh. So these impediments, these issues, my stuff, and the people who I think are my obstacles or impediments are not true. There is no impediment to, in this present moment, learning how to touch the possibilities for freedom, for happiness, for well-being, for ease. It is all here. It is a matter of what? Recognizing, noticing, and retraining. That's all. It's like any other significant learning experience that we've had. The kids are coming in at 4:45. Okay. It's 11:33. Okay. In the opening verse, a half smile is born upon my lips. I mean, that's a good way to start. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh has been a wonderful propagandizer for the half smile. He's even quoted all kinds of medical research about all the cells and the tissues and the muscles of your body. Anyhow, yeah, just a half smile. That's a very conscious way throughout the day to kind of, you know, it is hard to have a half smile on your face when you're angry. You have to make a choice at that point. Right? Unless you're a highly developed person. Maybe a highly developed person can be angry inside, or a highly deluded person, probably one or the other. But for most, it's a congruence. Just simply putting a half smile. It's not a grin. It's just a half smile. It's pleasant. It's a mudra of pleasantness. It's a mudra of well-being. Right? You know. That's a very simple way to begin to be part of this transformation. Many people find that uncomfortable. Might be people who are very self-conscious. See, we're not self-conscious about our frowns, about our seriousness, about our angry looks and our sad looks and our anxious looks. You know, those are fine. Oh, but don't ask me to put a half smile on my lips. That's kind of weird. I mean, that's how distorted things have gotten. So Thich Nhat Hanh is a great propagandizer of a half smile. Again, appreciation, gratitude. I mean, what a game changer. So many things that we have to be grateful for. People, situations. Even if one of our parts of our body is hurting, most of our body is not. We have been the receiver of so much support and caring and love and help since birth. Why don't we ever think of that? In our relationships, it's like la 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 la, then something goes wrong and it's like a big deal. We forget all the kindness, all the goodness, all the support, right? That's really been there. And instead, we just notice the incident. This mind distorts. In classical Buddhism, one of the greatest supporters of a happy mind is the mind of loving kindness. The mind of loving kindness is quite simply the mind that each of us feels toward friends, toward people we care about. In those situations, it is effortless, isn't it? It's the caring mind, it's the concerned mind, it's a mind that's naturally happy. Right? If you're out somewhere and all of a sudden you see a good friend coming down the aisle or driving, if you looked over and they were in the car next to you at a stoplight and you saw them, what would you do? You smile and you'd be happy. I'm happy to see you. That's the mind of loving kindness. It's not spiritual. It's not esoteric. It's not metaphysical. It's a natural aspect of our mind. When we acknowledge relationship. See, most of us think we can only acknowledge relationship with people that have passed endless criteria. You know, then we let them into our inner circle and we'll smile at them. But in the truest sense, we are all in this together. All human beings are in this together. we are all, in the truest sense, interconnected and part of the same family. That we all kind of more or less look alike and share many of the same characteristics and the same hopes and dreams and the same et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, why not have a sense of friendship toward all beings? Care about the well-being of all beings, which of course abstractly we understand, but we forget often that that really relates to real people. There are many people who practice these practices, these visualizations or these affirmations of loving kindness, but they say they have a hard time doing it with real people. Well, it's the practice is really about doing it with real people. We need to be reminded of that. And again, this sense of cultivating positive mind states. In the Buddhist teaching on energy, right energy, it really is delineated as one, there are four actually powers, aspects of this right energy. One is that one is very energetic in not cultivating arousing negative mind states. Two, when a negative mind state has arisen spontaneously, as they often do, we are very energetic in moving them quickly along and out. We don't cultivate them. So these are two aspects of being energetic in one's practice: is not consciously cultivating and arousing, and then not maintaining negative mind states. And you all know what negative mind states are. If you do not feel good, if there's not a sense of ease and well-being and lightness in you, you are cultivating a mind state that is negative. Is that clear? It's simple. You know it if you're in touch with how you feel. On the other hand, you are energetic in arousing, in cultivating positive mind states. And next, when a positive mind state has arisen within you, you are careful to cultivate that, to maintain that. That's where we're putting our energy. So this type of inner cultivation is very congruent with having a happy mind. It's interesting the word enlightenment, and maybe I'll just end on enlightenment. In the word of enlightenment, it has the word light. And I think that's important because there is a qualitative difference between light and darkness. And many of us, our emotions and our mind are kind of dark. And we want to brighten things up. But I think also enlightenment is a good word because it's a kind of a feeling word. There's a difference between heaviness and lightness. And many people feel heavy. Their hearts are heavy, or just they feel heavy, like a burden or something weighs me down. I don't feel free. I don't feel light. Again, that is often, again, because of what we're cultivating in our mind. And as I've done before, I just want to end with the great 8th century teacher of the way of compassion, Shantideva, who said, "All the world, all the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself." Is there need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves. Buddhas labor for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. We have 3 minutes. Are there any questions, practical questions about I mean, I think I tried to be practical today. Any questions about how to practice this? Yes.
Sort of taking it on yourself, I was thinking about how if I know if I see someone close to me or a colleague, coworker, boss, whatever, see doing something, notice immediately a sort of visceral reaction inside myself. And I was thinking, well, I suppose the process is that I see what's happening in myself, so I don't like that. So push that away, it must be their fault, if I can fix that away inside of me. I was wondering if you had anything to say, comment on like a sort of practicality, sort of pragmatic way to sort of deal with that.
Well, as I said earlier, I think it is a matter of, so the question is, a pragmatic way, because there's so much reactivity that just comes up viscerally, naturally, in the presence of certain situations, people, how do we deal with it? Again, you know, as I've said many times, to practice a spiritual path, to practice Dharma, is big picture. It's getting out of the world of dealing case by case. You deal by case, there's no end to it. There's no end to it. So we have to step back, and what's the big picture? The big picture, I don't have any idea what the situation is, but I know one thing. Everybody is acting the way they are acting because of causes and conditions. The situation is unfolding because of lots of causes and conditions, myriad causes and conditions. That's why it's arising that way, and that's why you're responding that way. Okay? So they're doing what they're doing, and you're feeling angry or hurt and want to do something, all because of causes and conditions. Now, when you understand that, and you see that that's what's going on, in that moment, you have the possibility of doing something else. The light's on. When the light's not on, we're just endlessly reacting, and just, it comes up, and we get hurt, we get angry, we blame, But when we understand the situation with wisdom and compassion, and we understand what's arising with us in the same way, and we understand, and we hold that in mindfulness, in awareness. We see the whole chain, right? And we see the whole chain that's led us to this moment. Like I see the chain that's led the kids to being outside there now, right? And so, therefore, I will stop. I won't continue talking. I'll respond to the situation. Okay. So I mean, there, the freedom is there. The thing that brought you and everybody else to that moment, that's all causes and conditions. But in that moment, if there is spaciousness in your mind and self-awareness, and you know that you can respond differently, it may take you a while. You may find that, reactivity still rules. But if you can begin to see that in awareness and it'll change. It's a process. But it's only going to happen in life. So with that, I will end. Thank you very much.